Thank you for choosing this GLT podcast. And while it's free to you, it's not free to produce. Please take a moment and make a contribution to pay for this program. Go to WGLT.org. And thank you.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. It's a conversation about landscaping as an environmental benefit. Noted environmental writer Douglas Tallamy explores landscaping that fills an environmental niche.
Dwarf chinkapin oak, dwarf chestnut oak, those things start making acorns at 5 feet tall. So you can have very powerful plants without them being gigantic.
Judy Valente has the interview with Tallamy, who talks about reducing the New England-sized amount of turf grass found in the United States. John Norton introduces you to the DIY touring punk band OC45. The band plays Night Shop in downtown Bloomington tonight. And the Coliseum fraud case is continuing to wind its way through the legal system. GLT's Ryan Denham has an update. All of that and a GLT news update on the way. It's April 23rd, 2018. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. There have been many twists and turns in the Coliseum fraud case since indictments were handed down last fall. Those cases are mostly still up in the air, and now there's a civil lawsuit, too. GLT's Ryan Denham has been following the case and periodically joins us on Sound Ideas for a status check. Ryan, thanks for stopping by the show.
Sure thing, Mike.
There are five criminal cases against five defendants, plus John Butler's civil lawsuit against the city. That means a lot of court filings. What makes the latest one different?
That's true. There have been a lot of filings. We've done a lot of stories on these cases. I can understand why there'd be a little bit of fatigue in that. I think this one is worth paying attention to, though. This is the first time that anyone's really laid out the inner workings of this alleged scheme. The bills of indictment that came back last fall that we all reported on, they were kind of light on the actual details of what was going on. And because they went before a grand jury to get indictments, prosecutors didn't really need to spell out the nitty-gritty of the case. So this filing that we're talking about today was made by the city. It was a part of the civil lawsuit that's been filed against the city by John Butler. He is kind of the top former manager of the Coliseum, now an arena it's called. And this filing was in response to his lawsuit. And the city is basically saying, not only do we not owe you money, John, for unpaid commissions, but here's all the ways that you allegedly conned us out of money that you owe us.
Sort of a defensive counterpunch, it sounds like.
Exactly.
So what exactly, can you refresh us on exactly what John Butler and the other defendants are accused of doing?
Sure. So back in March of 2016, this is almost exactly 2 years ago, John Butler's Central Illinois Arena Management, or SIAM, was running the arena. The city and SIAM failed to reach an agreement, and so John Butler's 10-year contract of running the arena runs out. It expires. And the city wanted more transparency in its new contract. You know, there was a new city manager and a new mayor since it was crafted, so they wanted some new stuff. They couldn't reach a deal. New managers of the arena are hired. It's VenueWorks. Soon after, someone there finds financial discrepancies and alerts the city to that. And the city calls the police. 16 months later, indictments against five former arena managers, including John Butler, 111 counts total. Since then, charges against one of those people have been dismissed. That's Bart Rogers. He's the former general manager at the arena. I kind of think of him as John Butler's number two. Those charges were dismissed for technical, like legal reasons. There was a statute of limitations issue that popped up. The bills of indictments were too vague. All those other cases are pending, and all the defendants have pleaded not guilty.
Is Bart Rogers free and clear at this point, as far as you understand it?
Well, it's possible that prosecutors could re-indict him. That's certainly on the table.
So what did we learn about how the alleged scheme actually worked?
So this court filing last week pulled back the curtain a bit. I give a couple of examples here. So John Butler's company, SIAM, was required to pay the city between a 32% and 42% commission on food and beverage sales at the arena. You buy a beer, pretzel, whatever. The city would get a smaller cut for food and beverage that was being sold through the suites or through catering. The city is now claiming that John Butler's company deliberately misclassified sales as being sweet or catering sales when they were actually just like the regular kind of beers and pretzels that were being sold that should have sent the city more money.
So about half the commission that was supposed to go to the city was going.
Yeah, thereabouts.
Yeah.
So to keep track of the alleged scheme, the city is claiming that the John Butler's company actually maintained like an internal secret document that was used to calculate these kind of phony commissions that were going to deprive the city of money. So the city says this internal document existed, but it never knew about it, not until these new managers at VenueWorks came in. Another claim is that John Butler's company was working with his sister company, a food and beverage thing, to basically alter concession sales that were coming out of the literal point of sale machines that you might see if you're like buying a beer or pretzel. Another accusation against John Butler's company, which is interesting, is that Butler's accused of using money from the city's Coliseum Fund, which is really meant for like operating expenses, to pay his own attorneys, including during the contract renegotiation period, right at the end of his time there. So if true, what that would mean is that the city was unknowingly paying a lawyer to negotiate against itself.
There's a pretty stunning claim in there about cleaning supplies. What's that all about?
It's kind of interesting, yeah. So in 2011, the city reimbursed John Butler's food and beverage company, BMI, after it bought a bunch of cleaning equipment. But then BMI allegedly rented the city paid for cleaning equipment to Siam, Butler's other company. So both those companies are owned by the same person. So the city is claiming that Siam would then bill the city as an operating expense for renting this cleaning equipment, even though the city had already paid for the equipment in full. So effectively, Siam billed the city to rent its own equipment. That's the accusation.
Based on these allegations, what's an example of how Butler was personally enriching himself? How did he line his own pockets?
So allegedly...
Allegedly.
Allegedly, yeah. I mean, these are all just accusations at this point. Lots of questions still. So one of these episodes that really stands out to me took place in March of 2016. Again, this is right as John Butler's contract with the city is about to end. He's about to leave. So days after John Butler walked away from negotiations with the city on reaching a new agreement, just like literally 3 days later, he allegedly tells the city that the Coliseum is a big cash flow problem. There's a $240,000 shortfall. Without the money, the Coliseum would not be able to pay utilities and payroll. So the city gives him this money. And now the city in its new filing is saying that Butler essentially pocketed $150,000 of that money into personal bank accounts, making like three transactions and moving it into his personal accounts, and never really paid the full utility bill that was owed. Weeks after this, the Butler's city contract expired. VenueWorks comes in. So the question is, like, why did the city do this? You know, it's a city building, so the city needs to pay for stuff. Still, by this time, the city already had some concerns about its visibility into the Coliseum's finances. Maybe they weren't thinking, you know, fraud yet, but they still had questions, so it certainly is an interesting move.
So did the city end up paying utility bills twice then, in effect, or do we know?
We don't really know, but if the utilities got paid, yeah, they would have.
Yeah. So you've done some reporting on the other side of this, the city of Bloomington and the oversight it provided to the arena during this time. Why did it file this new document in court?
So this filing, again, is on the civil side of this whole case, even though it does reveal stuff about the criminal allegations. That civil lawsuit, as a reminder, is over allegedly unpaid commissions that Butler says the city owes to him. City says, no, we don't. And even if we did, the contracts that you signed with all these sponsors and advertisers, we didn't sign off on them, and we renegotiated them anyway after VenueWorks came in. But now the city has filed this counterclaim, meaning it's seeking money from Butler, too. This 14-count countersuit against Butler is accusing him of like breach of contract, civil conspiracy, all that stuff. The city says it originally intended to wait for the criminal cases to kind of play out before seeking civil penalties, but in light of Butler's lawsuit against the city, they accelerated the plan.
So what does Butler and his attorneys have to say about all of this?
Well, on the criminal side, they've pleaded not guilty across the board, same with the other three defendants who have cases outstanding. The defense appears to be arguing that this is still a civil contract dispute, not a criminal matter. If the city had concerns about the flow of money, they should have pursued arbitration, not called the cops. Also, the defense says that Butler relied on the accuracy of the city's own annual audits of the Coliseum. If those didn't find anything, how would Butler know something was wrong? So we'll have to wait and see how that all kind of plays out.
So what's next?
Civil lawsuit goes back to court in the summer in July. Criminal cases are still pending. Notably, prosecutors have seen some staff shakeups that may be coming down the pike that may impact the case. Jason Chambers, state's attorney, has applied to become a judge. His first assistant, Adam Grist, is one of the lead prosecutors in the case, and he's leaving for a job in the federal U.S. attorney's office.
Ryan Denham is the digital content director at GLT. He's been covering the Coliseum fraud case. You can read more of this story now at WGLT.org. Ryan, thanks for stopping by Sound Ideas.
Thanks, Mike.
Support for GLT comes from the University of Illinois system. Three universities, Urbana-Champaign, Chicago, and Springfield, one system, and a $14 billion economic impact from students, alumni, and employees statewide. Altogether extraordinary. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. There's another hat in the ring for governor. Longtime GOP State Senator Sam McCann has announced a run, though not as a Republican. That's the focus of this week's Illinois Politics Roundtable. Sean Crawford moderates the panel with IPR Statehouse reporter Brian Mackey, Monique Garcia of the Chicago Tribune, Charlie Wheeler of the University of Illinois at Springfield, and IPR's Daisy Contreras round out the panel. McCann is a frequent critic of Governor Rauner. Contreras says McCann says he's going to try to fix Rauner's mistakes if elected.
You know, this is interesting because Rauner already has a difficult road ahead of him to try to bring together the ultra-conservative voters who voted for Jeannie Ives. What McCann is trying to do is he's trying to appeal to these voters, Ives' base, to come over and vote for him. These are votes that Rauner desperately needs to win the elections in November.
Monique, we know Sam McCann here, those that cover the legislature, and here in central Illinois because he covers even a part of Springfield with that state Senate district. But is he really well-known enough outside of that area? Is he a serious challenger in any way?
Well, I think the concern for the Rauner camp is they view him as a spoiler. Senator McCann has gained some name recognition in the past couple years because he's famously fought with the governor on several labor issues. He's sided with unions in areas where the governor has tried to push back against some of their control. And indeed, Senator McCann is backed by a union in this effort. They gave him quite a bit of money to launch this bid for governor. And so for Rauner, the concern is, you know, he needs every Republican vote he can get, and this can really siphon off some of those supporters.
To that point, I think it's telling that McCann is not launching a independent bid for governor. He's launching a third party bid, and that party's name is the Conservative Party, right? Governor Rauner, as Daisy pointed out, just narrowly avoided losing the primary against a more conservative Republican challenger and State Representative Jeannie Ives. And now here's somebody who's going to be running in the Conservative Party. I mean, he might as well have just, you know, called the party the Not Rauner Party or something like that for what the, you know, apparent aim of this effort is.
Charlie, right, and when he launched his bid, Senator McCann called Governor Rauner a rhino, a Republican in name only, and he points to these issues that Jeannie Ives really seized on in her campaign. That is the governor's signing of a bill to expand access or expand taxpayer funding of abortions, and also him signing legislation that expanded protections for immigrants who are in the state illegally.
Well, he did resign from the Republican caucus, not as a state senator. He is not going to run again as a state senator, so he's in his final months in office there. But, Charlie, do you remember anything like this happening before where somebody took on the sitting governor of their own party and took such drastic action here as to try to make a bid like this?
Well, I can't recall anyone who was elected as a member of a particular party then launching a third-party bid. But if you look back, when was it? Was it 2006, when the Reverend James Meeks, who was a Democratic state senator, talked about running as an independent against Rod Blagojevich, and that never came to pass. And Meeks's issue was funding for elementary and secondary education, particularly schools that had a lot of kids who were low-income, kids of color, And Blagojevich, in essence, promised that he would increase education funding by something like $6 billion over the next several years. And Meeks was satisfied with that, and he never really did. He never did go through, and he wasn't on the ballot as an independent. I can't remember somebody running, though, who started out as a Democrat or a Republican, and then sort of midstream decided that they would run as a third-party candidate. The Green Party had a candidate for governor against Blagojevich, got more than 10% of the vote, which established the Green Party as a, I don't know what the right word would be, I guess an established political party. Yeah. Which meant the next time around, they had to get just a fraction of the number of signatures that McCann will have to get. McCann, if I'm not mistaken, will have to get 25,000 valid signatures on the petition. And I also believe the rules are that if someone voted in the primary, as I did, that person is not eligible to sign a petition for a third-party candidate until the next election season rolls around.
So, Brian, is this really, you know, is this even worth the time? It seems to me that Democrats are not going to necessarily vote for Sam McCann. They weren't going to vote for Rauner either. But they know that they're going to want J.B. Pritzker for governor, so they're going to vote for him. I would think labor groups would probably back Pritzker. Who's he really talking to here? Is it the Jeannie Ives voter, or are they even going to be willing to go along with him?
Well, I guess that depends. Who knows what's in the minds of the voters? But I think that who he's targeting, yes, is clearly that Jeannie Ives voter. As Monique, I think it was pointed out, Local 150, which is the International Union of Operating Engineers, Local 150, they gave a $50,000 contribution to McCann the same week that he made this announcement. And they are a party that has done some of this, unconventional political strategies in the past. I mean, they encouraged, their Democrats to support Kirk Dillard against Bruce Rauner in the Republican primary 4 years ago. So this is not the first time that they have, taken, non-straightforward means of attempting to influence an election outcome. And I think that particularly labor unions are so unhappy with Governor Rauner and his policy agenda that they don't want to leave any opportunity to on the table, right? Who knows what might come out about the Democratic candidate? We've already had the Blagojevich tapes that Monique's newspaper, the Chicago Tribune, has reported on. Who knows what else might come out about him? And so anything they can do to try and improve his chances, and in order to do that by diminishing Governor Rauner's chances, I think they're going to try and seize that opportunity.
Well, the Rauner campaign said Sam McCann called him the worst kind of political opportunist. So the former GOP chair Pat Brady had some negative things to say. He also said this is labor. This is not Sam McCann running as a, on a conservative platform. This is labor backing him. Daisy, what were some other, were we hearing a lot from other people at the Capitol about this? Was there a lot of discussion on it?
Well, some people are saying that McCann is this candidate who has debt in history of debt, and when asked about this, McCann answered that this actually makes him a more relatable candidate as opposed to Pritzker or Rauner, who probably don't really have to worry about issues like that.
Yet it occurs to me too that we're all thinking about the people who supported Jeannie Ives because they thought that Bruce Rauner was basically a social liberal, and they are socially conservative. But thinking about it, there are a lot of Democrats, particularly in southern Illinois and in some of the western areas of Illinois, who are equally socially conservative. And so if they have a choice between, assuming McCann makes the ballot, if they have a choice between a Democratic candidate who is very much pro-choice and a Republican candidate who is very much pro-choice, and a conservative party candidate who is very much pro-life, they may be tempted to vote for the pro-life guy.
And of course, the big issue still, as you mentioned, he's got to get on the ballot. We'll see how that goes going forward.
Sean Crawford moderates the Illinois Politics Roundtable with Charlie Wheeler of the University of Illinois at Springfield, Daisy Contreras and Brian Mackey of IPR, and the Chicago Tribune's Monique Garcia. You're listening to Sound Ideas. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's Public Media. I'm Mike McCurdy. Everyone needs to think ahead to retirement, whether that time is far in the future or just a few years away. Ronald Pressman is an executive with the nonprofit financial service provider TIAA and says baby boomers need to make sure their retirement benefits live as long as they do. And millennials need to start to act now to make sure their plans for retirement get off to a good start. Pressman talks with Illinois Public Media's Jim Meadows about how to prepare for retirement in today's world.
I know when I started my career, which now is 38 years ago, I never really thought about my retirement because I believed in a system. I believed in Social Security. I believed in a defined benefit from my employer. Today we live in a world where the sense is people have many careers, many employers. The concept of having a defined benefit stream in the future that they can have confidence in doesn't really exist. So they have to be more planful, and we need to help them. Financial services is a morass of tools and capabilities, but it's actually really quite simple to live a life of financial security and financial well-being.
If you're not able to count on a defined benefit, if you're expecting to change employers, if you're working essentially as a contractor, what are the alternatives and how can you know what's going to work best for you?
So, Jim, you've just kind of defined what some people refer to as the gig economy. So the keys, of course, are save early and as much as you can. We would recommend people save at a rate of about 15% of their salary into savings from literally day one. And if they do that consistently, they'll be on a good path from a savings rate standpoint. So that's point number one. Point number two is then to think very thoughtfully about how you invest in the investing markets. You can invest in equities or debt. Equities are higher volatility, but higher earnings over time for your portfolio. Debt, lower earnings, lower volatility. When you're young, you're not as worried about volatility, so heavily weight toward equity programming. As you get older, you're more focused on volatility. You might want to be in a position to now convert that accumulation into a life kind of salary program during your retirement years. You don't want to be prone to a market dislocation like we had in 2008, 2009 that suddenly hits you and be 100% in equities. Make sure you're thinking about your asset allocation between debt and equities over time.
So you would recommend not reacting to changes in the economy or the stock market, not even when you see long-term changes happening?
It's not necessarily that you're not reacting to them, but you're keeping them in context. Many people have been imprinted with a sense of real concern and fear what happened in the financial crisis in 2008, 2009. If you look at the 50% drop in the equity market in 2009, it seemed horrendous at the time. But looked upon over a 20-year cycle, which is the way you should think about your retirement money, it hardly shows up on a chart charting equity returns over 20 years. So if you pulled your money out and didn't have the confidence to keep it in, then you will have missed the opportunity to improve your economics dramatically in the recovery from that cycle.
What if you're nearing retirement? How would you react to changes you see in the stock market and the economy?
Yeah, there your antenna needs to be up. You want to be gradually shifting at least a portion of whatever you've accumulated into a vehicle that will be very low volatility. Maybe not generating as much return, but low volatility, because you want that to be your personal safety net. In an environment where some of the safety nets of the past have disappeared, you need a predictable life income stream. More importantly, you should be changing your asset allocation to a lower volatility mix anyway, because you're preparing yourself to convert that into a life income stream during your retirement.
Ronald Pressman spoke with IPR's Jim Meadows about planning for retirement. Pressman is the CEO for Institutional Financial Services at TIAA. You're listening to Sound Ideas.
Support for GLT comes from the Illinois Symphony Orchestra, featuring Beethoven's Pastoral Symphony, which depicts his love of nature, complete with a symphonic thunderstorm. World-renowned pianist Stephen Huff closes the season in Brahms' powerful first piano concerto, Sunday, April 29th at the BCPA. Tickets at islesymphony.org. This is GLT.
We asked current GLT contributors to talk with those who haven't made a first-time pledge to this public radio station.
We're just so fortunate that we have it, because there's so much garbage news out there.
It's important for members of the local community to help support something really kind of special that's going on in Bloomington Normal.
If you don't give, this could go away. I'm Carolyn Pitts, and I'm asking you to make a first-time contribution. Do your part to support GLT.
Make your first-time contribution at WGLT.org. Contribute $10 a month to support GLT, and you'll hear it working for you all year long. Every day, no matter the program you're tuned to, you'll know your contribution is helping to make it happen. It's a budget-friendly way to support GLT, and it makes a real difference here. The GLT Fund Drive is underway. It takes just a minute to set up your ongoing contribution at WGLT.org. I'm Mike McCurdy. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas. Spring is sprung and the grass is risen, but that's not necessarily a great thing, according to noted environmental writer Douglas Tallamy. Tallamy is speaking at Heartland Community College tomorrow. GLT's Judy Valente spoke by Skype with Tallamy and has more about what to do to foster nature in your own backyard.
Douglas Tallamy believes every person with a patch of front or backyard can be a conservationist. He is the author of such books as Bringing Nature Home and, most recently, The Living Landscape. An entomologist at the University of Delaware, Tallamy says humans are but one element in our ecosystem, and when one element of that chain suffers, we all do. He warns that humans have overrun the vast majority of natural landscapes across Illinois and indeed America. Tallamy says humans created this problem and can reverse the trend.
We have landscaped forever only from the perspective of aesthetics. So we've considered plants to be decorations, and we're going to decorate the world with our plants. That's okay, except for all the other critically important things that plants do. We humans have such a giant footprint. If we don't pay attention to the ecological roles of plants, in addition to their aesthetic roles, then we face ecosystem collapse. So I'm trying to reach a compromise here, saying yes, you can have a pretty yard, but you have to have a functional yard too.
What do you suggest as step one on a practical level for people wanting to be both ecologically sound and have a pretty yard?
Step one, I would say, is consider reducing the area you have in lawn. Most people use lawn as a default, and when they're tired of landscaping, everything else becomes lawn.
What does that mean? It becomes lawn? It becomes grass?
That's right. Turf grass, you know, acres and acres of turf grass. We have an area in turf grass the size of New England right now in the U.S., and we're adding 500 square miles a year. So if we can reduce the area that's in lawn to the places where we actually walk, and fill in all of that lawn we're replacing with productive plants, you've gone a long, long way to meeting the requirements that we all have to start meeting.
Okay, what are productive plants then? What kind of plants should people be putting in? Because most people think of azaleas or impatiens.
Well, right. People are picking their plants by what they look like. You know, are they going to be a good decoration? But if I said, I want you to support a food web. This plant has to make a lot of food that are going to feed the birds and everything else. It has to sequester carbon. It's got to manage the watershed. The very best plants to do that are those large woody plants, and oaks top the list in terms of doing all of those things.
So plant an oak in your front yard or your backyard? What if you don't have the space to do that?
Most people do. Don't picture your oak as if it's 300 years old, because it's probably not going to get there. Plant it small, and even if it fills a space eventually, you can go 50 years with having a very productive plant in your yard before it causes a problem. Not only that, we have dwarf oaks, dwarf chinkapin oak, dwarf chestnut oak. Those things start making acorns at 5 feet tall. So you can have very powerful plants without them being gigantic.
What about plants? Let's talk plants. We're here in central Illinois. What kind of plants would be helpful for the environment?
Okay. You know, a lot of people are talking about pollinators, making pollinator gardens. It means putting flowering plants in your yard that are going to provide the nutrition needed by our pollinators. And we're really talking about our native bees here. So in the Midwest and Illinois there, I think there's 12 species of bees that will only reproduce on sunflower pollen. So if you don't have sunflowers, you've lost 12 species of bees right there. Goldenrod is always very, very high on that list.
How do you make this less complicated for people who say, you know, I just want my garden to look nice, but I also want to attract butterflies. I want to attract bees right. because they're good.
We're working on that, and we actually have a website now that is up on the National Wildlife Federation website. It's called Native Plant Finder. And if you put in your zip code, the top-ranked plants that do all these things will pop up for your county. So this zeroes in on the plants that are good where you live. And that can make it easy. Remember, if you spend a half an hour planting that oak tree in your yard and never do another thing, you have made your yard very productive for the next 100 years. So it doesn't take constant monitoring.
It sounds like it's an expensive proposition, and that may be a stumbling block for some people.
I'm going to argue against that. Most people don't even mow their own lawn. They hire a lawn care company. Which is expensive. If you reduce the area of your lawn by 50%, you've just saved yourself a lot of money. I'm not going to pretend that putting these plants in is maintenance-free and doesn't cost anything. But once your yard is established, maintenance really does drop off. And I think in the long run, it does actually save you money.
Because native plants are perennials.
Most of them are perennials. You can get annuals, but most of them are perennials, absolutely.
Let's talk a little bit about insects. You're very big on insects, and this is a farming area, and uh-huh. There's a lot of people who think of insects simply as pests to mm-hmm. be eradicated. You say that's wrong-headed thinking.
Sure. Think of the monarch butterfly, for example. That is not eating our soybeans. It's not eating our corn. It's not a pest in any way. It develops on milkweeds. If you take away the milkweeds, when we spray indiscriminately to remove, quote, weeds, and it removes those flowering native plants that support the monarch, that support our native bees, the things that support most of the wildlife out there. And in a lot of places, we're converting that into lawn. So these are deadscapes in the name of protecting our crops. But we're really fighting things that actually protect our crops. I mean, bees are good things for pollination. They did all the pollinating before we brought the honeybee over from Europe. So there are consequences to eliminating what really amounts to are the little patches of nature that are left. We need nature. Everybody has this idea that there's a lot of nature out there, but Illinois is a perfect place to drive around and see that is not true. That is not true anymore. We've converted it into our human-dominated landscapes. You know, we've rather mindlessly created just these pretty landscapes, but they are not ecologically functional.
You're listening to Sound Ideas. I'm Judy Valente. Douglas Tallamy is an ecologist, author, and environmentalist. And we're talking about creating living landscapes. What do you say to people who are using pesticides of some sort?
90% of the time, it's totally unnecessary. What you need to do is create a balanced food web in your yard so that you have the natural enemies that will protect your garden naturally without pesticides. You don't get wrapped up in this pesticide loop. We know when we spray, the very first things we kill are the natural enemies of the pests we're trying to control. And that means then you have to keep spraying because all the natural enemies are gone. So we don't want to get caught up in that treadmill. In our home gardens, most people spray. They spray things like spiders, which are actually helping us. They'll spray things like box elder bug, which is completely harmless and sits on the side of our house just to keep warm in the fall. You know, it's not eating the house, not eating anything. Because we've got this notion that all insects are bad, and if you see one, you have to kill it. But I started to say earlier, E.O. Wilson has told us that insects are the little things that run the world. They're doing absolutely everything, and if they disappeared, we wouldn't last in this planet but a few months. And yet, studies that are actually starting to look at the decline of insects around the world show we've lost about 45% of them so far. Very bad idea if those are the things that are actually keeping us alive. So we have to look beyond our little immediate environment and realize that these are essential components of our ecosystems, and to mindlessly kill them when we're not even sure why we're doing that is a bad idea.
You mentioned there are other ways than pesticides. What other ways can people do, for example, in their own little plot of land, backyard?
Soapy water is a wonderful solution. That's not going to poison you. It's not going to give your pets leukemia and tumors.
Would that work also for roses? I know I have rose bushes that often get full of Japanese beetles.
Japanese beetle is here, and it has very few natural enemies.
So what do I do about my Japanese beetles?
What do you do about Japanese beetles? What I do is I get a bucket of soapy water. They often, aggregate maybe on your roses or on the tip of a branch or something, and just hold the bucket underneath there and tap them. They all fall right into the water. It works.
What main point are we missing about how we do gardening today?
The main point we're missing is that humans are part of nature. We cannot live without it. We can't pretend that it is, that it's optional. So we have to start to incorporate it into the way we live, into the landscapes we design, into our behaviors. We have to start to connect those isolated habitats that are out there so that they're not isolated anymore. We really have to redesign our relationship with the planet. And saying, well, I want a pretty lawn, that's not good enough reason to destroy the planet. It just doesn't work anymore.
Douglas Tallamy is a professor of entomology at the University of Delaware. He's a noted ecologist and author. Thanks so much for talking about all of this.
No, you're quite welcome.
I'm Judy Valente.
Tallamy speaks tomorrow at 7 p.m. at the Astroth Community Education Center at Heartland Community College. His free talk is sponsored by the Illinois Prairie Wild Ones Conservation Group. It's Sound Ideas on GLT. I'm Mike McCurdy. Community Players puts the spotlight on a wildly dysfunctional family for its latest production. Laura Kennedy has more in this edition of GLT's Datebook.
August, Osage County by Tracy Letts is a multi-award-winning play, Tonys and a Pulitzer, and it's opening with a preview May 3rd at Community Players in Bloomington. John Poling is the director of this biting comedy drama. He says while there's 13 characters on stage, there's really a 14th character as well.
And that's the Oklahoma heat in August, because along with the alcohol and the drugs and just mental issues, period, the heat also brings out another element of all these people that is not the most attractive sometimes.
Tell me about Violet, the matriarch of this family, where the father goes missing at the beginning of the play.
Correct. And then Violet generally has just lived in this house with Bev, her husband, and just the two of them. For the most part, they do have an older daughter named Ivy that lives somewhere nearby. But the other two daughters, one lives in Colorado and one lives in Florida. And so when Bev, the patriarch of the family, goes missing, then all the children come home to support Violet and figure out what's happened to Bev. And of course, we do find that out at the end of the first act. What then springs from all that is a lot of pent up anger, resentment, issues, dysfunction amongst these people, and it all gets played out.
Now, we all go home from work or school at the end of the day, and we deal with our own family dysfunction. Why should we pick ourselves up and go to the theater to watch another family's dysfunction?
I would say, for one thing, it makes you feel a lot better about your own family's dysfunction.
I'm always looking for that.
That's right. As bad as you think your family might be, trust me, it is not anywhere close to as bad as this family is. And it's terrible to say, but a family's dysfunction can be very entertaining at times, and certainly is with this play.
So what we have is a drama with comedy in it. How do you work on that balance between the humor and the drama in this show?
That's a really good question, because it's always billed as kind of a black comedy drama kind of a thing. And for anyone that's actually seen the movie, they tease out more the dramatic elements than the comedic elements.
Well, Meryl Streep is in it, so.
Exactly. So of course you're going to do that. Yes, mm-hmm. Right? But yeah, I mean, one of the things that I've worked with the cast is just telling them to kind of expect the unexpected. There will probably be times that people will laugh at certain things, and then other nights they won't find those things necessarily funny, you know?
That must be weird for an actor to throw that out there, and you're expecting a laugh and you don't get it. And then
right.
The next night, they are laughing. That would sort of unsettle me.
Yes. Well, and as an actor, you've just tried to be prepared for that type of thing because you just never know. And I mean, I've been in productions as an actor where there's things that are really very intensely serious going on. And you actually get a person or two in the audience who kind of laughs. And it's really out of nervousness more than anything else, their own uncomfortableness with what's happening. And you just have to go with the flow when something like that happens. But there are a lot of very funny comedic things that happen in it. There is a dinner scene at the end of Act Two that's it just swings wild between the comedic and the dramatic kind of thing, but it's hilarious. Parts of it are.
Well, this originated in Steppenwolf Theater and then went to Broadway and scooped up a bunch of Tonys, and they made a film out of it as well. And as I mentioned, Meryl Streep is in it, and there's also Julia Roberts. Now, if you've already seen the film, will this ruin the play for you at all, or are these kind of different entities?
I don't know that I would say it would ruin the play. Certainly, there are several twists in it that you will definitely obviously know at that point if you've seen the movie. I think you will just find it overall a funnier piece of work as the play than as the movie.
So what is the takeaway for audiences from August Osage County?
Well, that's a really good question. And because I think people are going to leave this show maybe a bit confused about how they feel about the whole thing. You know, are they glad they visited this family for 2.5 hours, or are they really like, I don't like these people and I don't really know why Tracy Letts wrote a show about these people kind of thing. But I think that sometimes the best kind of theater is that makes you think and not really sure about how you feel about these. And maybe you have to think about it for a day or two after you've seen it to really kind of sort out your feelings about what you've just seen.
That's John Poling, director of August, Osage County, running May 3rd through the 13th. At Community Players in Bloomington. I'm Laura Kennedy.
The title of the play, August Osage County, is taken from a poem by the late Howard Starks, who was once the mentor of playwright Tracy Letts. Director John Poling says the show is for mature audiences. You're listening to Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. From a dilettante college band at the University of New Hampshire to a dedicated punk group on the road 7 years later, the members of the Boston-based OC45 still don't take themselves too seriously. The way they view their music is another matter entirely. OC45 plays Night Shop in downtown Bloomington tomorrow night. GLT's John Norton has more via Skype with the band's guitarist and vocalist, Derek Rossi.
This song from OC45 is titled GCRP. It's a song rooted in the controversy of the band's original name, Old Crow and the 45s. The name was an impulsive choice by band members who needed one when asked unexpectedly to play a gig on their University of New Hampshire campus. Derek Rossi says they later used it on a MySpace page because they didn't have a better name. Rossi says it wasn't long before the fledgling band received a letter. It was from the attorney representing the folk bluegrass band Old Crow Medicine Show.
And it was a cease and desist request that we stop using the term Old Crow in our name at the time because we weren't really serious or doing anything, or and we didn't even like the name anyway. It was just kind of a placeholder. And we had been kind of like abbreviating it to OC45 just for our own purposes anyway. So we just decided to use that when I came back and we fired it up. And then, you know, like for a while there, we weren't really big fans of the name OC45 either, but we kind of were like touring a little bit and recording and making shirts and merch. So we didn't really have much choice but to keep it at that point. And now we've had it for 7 years. I mean, like the whole thing is a joke. Like we weren't a serious band. The fact that they felt the need to send that was kind of hilarious to us.
Were you familiar with Old Crow and the Medicine Show before that even happened?
Wagon Wheel. I mean, I think that's pretty much all anybody really knew or knows.
Oh, by the way, GCRP? Rossi says it stands for Geriatric Crow Remedy Performance. Not that they're bitter. You've already sort of hinted at it. You didn't really take yourself very seriously when you were
just getting going, and even maybe a few years into it, you guys weren't taking yourself too seriously. Even the name of your website right now claims that you guys suck, right? So are you 7 or 8 years out now? Are you kind of surprised you're still doing this?
I would say so, yeah. When we first started the band, we were just doing it because we enjoyed playing music. Like, me and Nick, our bass player, grew up together in Rhode Island. And we used to jam in his basement every single day from, like, when I was probably 15 through high school. And then even after, when I'd come home from college, we'd always play. I think we played one thing that could have been considered a show once, but it was, like, just a train wreck, and it was awful. So when I met Adam later, he had been in a band in high school, too. They had actually played a couple gigs, so we were like, oh, cool, this guy knows what he's doing. Like, this is our in to being a band. Turns out Adam had no idea what he was doing either. I mean, we had some friends in DIY bands that had done some DIY touring, and we just got the idea one day to go for it. And we did our first U.S. tour like a year after we formed, spent 5 weeks out on the road, and it was kind of a bit of a disaster, but in all like the right ways, basically. So when we came back, there was no hesitation where he was going to keep doing it.
By the way, we're talking with Derek from the OC45 band. That'll be at Night Shop tonight. I want to play a song from the latest album, Happy Accidents. It's the Ones and Zeros song, and it seems to address the fear that somebody, maybe you guys, have of becoming stale and boring. Let me play just a little bit of the song. Having heard just that now, you've released a number of albums, have you talked about? You've toured the country numerous times. You've even, what, been in Europe now, touring a little bit.
Yeah, we did one out there last May, and we're going back out in October.
So it sounds like you guys don't want to be stale. You don't want to be boring. You don't want that white picket fence prison, as you're saying in there. But what's different now than maybe 7 or 8 years ago? Is it a little more serious now?
The band is definitely more serious. I would say that for myself, I guess, it took a few years of doing the band to realize that that was all I wanted to do. So, I mean, I have a college degree in business administration with a focus on accounting. For a little while, I guess I always kind of thought that that's maybe where I would end up. And then after a couple of years and a couple of tours, and there was no going back. I was grateful that I made it to the point where I could make that independent decision. I was just kind of going through the motions before that. Pretty much a prime example of what's wrong with our school system in America.
How's that?
I kind of just floated through, got really great grades without really learning much, and I didn't learn how to really think independently or pursue my own interests at all. I sort of just fell in line and rejected that, basically. I knew that was something I didn't want to do while I was in college, but I didn't really have the balls to do anything else.
This is GLT Sound Ideas. I'm John Norton talking with Derek Rossi from the band OC45 playing Night Shop in downtown Bloomington tonight. There's a whole bunch of songs we could get to, but time is going to limit us. I want to go to Keep Your Guns from the Happy Accidents album, and it's a really interesting few set of lyrics that you wrote, looks like a year or two ago, that kind of dovetail right into today. I want to play just a little bit of this song right now.
Bring a clock to the movies, sit way up in the back. Celebrate up and carry, unless your muslim or black. Let some of the teachers invest in our schools, cause when you're on the teeth, yeah, you can write your moves.
So let's go from here, Derek. You guys are all pretty much what, your mid to late 20s right now?
Yep, I just turned 30 a couple weeks ago. Nick is about to turn 29, Adam's 31. Yeah, we're all about in that area.
Okay, so it was about elementary school, maybe junior high, when Columbine happened. Is that about right?
Yeah.
Keeping this song we're playing in mind, how has that and the subsequent shootings and the school drills and all that affected your world outlook?
Ugh, God, it's so depressing. I just realized, I guess, like, this song was born from just like this feeling of numbness to the problem. And like, obviously there's some sort of issue. There's some problem here, whether that's guns or mental health, a combination of the two, poverty, racial bias, like there's all sorts of stuff. But if we don't want to address it, and we obviously have problems doing that as a country, it's like, what do we do here? Just keep your guns. I don't care if I have to live in a world where maybe I'll get shot just so you can have your Second Amendment right, I guess. You know, like, you kind of just throw your hands up in the air.
Well, it was so stunning to hear the lyric in the song, "Let's arm all the teachers, invest in our schools, because when you're armed to the teeth, you can write your own rules." I was kind of stunned coming out of the Parkland thing as a parent of a now 20-year-old that all the drills that had been going on in school, I didn't hear about. I don't know if a lot of parents really knew that was going on a regular basis.
Yeah, I mean, I think most of the drills and stuff were probably a little after our time. I don't really remember doing much of that when we were in school. But I mean, also the shootings were a lot less common when I was in high school. And I don't know, it's just crazy that those lyrics, even though they were topical then, they're just as relevant right now. I mean, it's only a year or two, but what we've learned through punk rock is that we're still writing the same songs people wrote in the 80s. You know, like it's, the topics are still there, the struggles are still pretty much the same.
So, as you mentioned, you know, you're writing about the same things that punk bands in the 80s were writing about, but there's an interesting kind of little twist on the album called Dad's Home. It's a really touching song. Who wrote that song?
That's Adams. His father passed away in, I think it was 2016, and he had long had some health issues, and in Adams' relationship with his father was a really serious one. And so, yeah, when that all happened, that was kind of his way of expressing that, you know.
Let me ask it this way then. Was his dad or are your parents pretty thrilled for what you guys are doing, or are they stereotypical, oh my God, get a real job type of parents?
It might have been a little bit more the latter at first, but the longer that we've been doing it, and I mean, they see the ripples from what we've been doing. They see that there are people like all over the country and all over the world asking us to come back, people who like are thrilled to open their doors and like have us crash with them. I mean, we've just built so many relationships and done so many things that are kind of unusual that I think at this point they're just like, wow, they're kind of more impressed than anything.
Derek Rossi of the punk band OC45 speaking with John Norton via Skype. OC45 plays Night Shop in downtown Bloomington tonight. Discover more local music on the GLT podcast. Find it on NPR One or your favorite podcast app. That's where you can find the full Sound Ideas podcast as well. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal.